This is Small School Big Tech, Episode 1, with another Schwab. That's Andrew Schwab for not on Twitter, and I teach ag, Danny Silva.
Yeah, that was good. I forgot to introduce us. Okay, let's just get started. How professional is this podcast going to be?
I don't know. What do you want? I mean, we could talk about lots of different stuff. So.
I don't think we really defined what it is this is going to be about.
Okay. You want to start?
Sure.
Okay.
All right, so what are we talking about?
We
can talk about lots of stuff. We should probably introduce ourselves first, I guess. And I'll start with that. So my name's Andrew Schwab. I'm the IT director at LeGrand Union High School District. I have been doing IT for the district for about 6 years on and off. And LeGrand is a small rural district. We have about 550 students district-wide with two schools, main high school and a continuation school. And I don't know, I think we've been pushing the envelope, I think, with technology here for such a small school. I think we have a lot going on. And we kind of wanted to get the word out. So last year I did a separate presentation, and it was called Small School Big Tech, and this podcast kind of flowed from that. So who are you?
And I'm Danny Silva. For those of you on Twitter, I'm iTeachAg, and I've been teaching at LeGrand High School for 8 years, and I am an agriculture instructor as well as an administrator, technology coordinator, a little bit of everything. Small school, you know, you get everything for everybody. And I've been helping Andrew getting excited about all the cool things that we could do on campus, and we usually come up with some really cool ideas way ahead of everybody else. Our problem is we don't publicize, and so nobody knows about it. And then everybody else does it afterwards.
Well, and I think, some people are probably better at publicizing than us. But then again, you know, you have, what, 5 titles? I have, like, 3. I think we're pretty busy. I'm actually impressed that we got to sit down today to do this because I think we've been talking about it forever. Starting a podcast. So let's see, I got CBQ tomorrow where I'm going to do Small School Big Tech, the presentation.
Yeah, that's Saturday. And then I'll be there as well with getting the most out of Google Calendar. And so we've built a website. We're building our brand here with Small School Big Tech. You can find us on Small School Big Tech for Twitter. That's a Small School, SM School Big Tech. And we also have a website, www.smallschoolbigtech.com. And so you can find all of our presentations there.
And let's see. I guess this first episode, we could probably just talk about, we did the intro, so we kind of covered that. I'll run through Small School Big Tech, the presentation, just really quick, because I think that gives a good overview of kind of where we are with technology.
Sounds like a plan.
Okay, so small school big tech, it's basically talking about some of the free and open source tools that we use here to manage our network and provide technology to staff and students. The first tool that I really talk about is for monitoring the network, so bandwidth utilization, and it's called IP Audit Web. And basically, it runs under Linux, and you install it, and it passively monitors your network. So you can see what your hosts are doing, who's taking up all your bandwidth. It's just a really simple tool to set up and use, and really gives you a good picture of what's happening on your network. And then about a year ago, we started looking at web filtering alternatives. Because, like a lot of small schools out there, we were basically buying service from our county office of ed,
and then we were using WebSense, so that was twice as bad because the county made WebSense lock down completely.
Well, we were not able to do things, basic things like block or unblock our own sites or view reports, so we were really restricted in what we were able to do.
And when we wanted a site fix, next, we had to get a letter from the superintendent just to open up a website. So it was quite cumbersome.
Yes. So I went out looking for alternatives, and what I found from the commercial alternatives was they were very expensive. And so if I was going to make a change, it pretty much had to be free. And, you know, I knew enough about Linux and Squid and Dan's Guardian, those kind of things, where I was kind of looking in that direction. But then I came across a product called Untangle, which is basically they have taken a whole bunch of open source applications and bundled them into a nice GUI interface. And they operate on the freemium model, so they provide basic services for free. You can download it and try it. And then they have premium services you can pay for. They do have a very nice education package with special pricing for education. But basically, I decided I would run the free version just kind of to try it out. And I didn't really have any hardware available, so I pulled an old Dell desktop off the shelf. And just nothing fancy, straight Pentium 4, 2.8 gigahertz, you know, a couple gigs of RAM, a couple 100 meg Linksys NICs. And I installed Untangle on there, ran that for a year in tandem with WebSense, and I also used another product called OpenDNS, which I'll talk about in a second. But basically, I had the entire school district being filtered through this little Dell box, about 300 computers and 650 users, and it worked great. So besides being free, the thing I really liked about it was it did more than just web filtering. I mean, that was a great bonus for us to be able to now manage our own web filtering, but it also did, or it does, it provides fish filtering, spam filtering, virus filtering on the network level. It'll do protocol analysis. It allows us to do quality of service. It has an open VPN client and server, so unlimited remote access. I don't pay per user. I don't pay anything for VPN remote access. It's got web-based reports, and then when I decided to put it into production, there were a couple things that I really thought we needed that we couldn't get out of the free version, so we did buy the education package. And what that gave us was it allowed us to set different policies based on subnet or user, as well as time. And we really wanted to do that so that we could have a separate policy for staff and versus a separate policy for students. Primarily to block things like social networking, YouTube.
And it's been nice because then we were able to turn on Facebook for students at certain times of the day and turn it off other times, and the staff were allowed to be on it at any time, such as YouTube and things. But we're thinking now that we might be opening up for the students the same as staff, just because we should be teaching them how to correctly be on the internet and not just blocking them from everything.
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to that. What is the the philosophical debate? You know, is internet filtering something that IT should be doing, or, you know, should it be a classroom management issue? I personally don't think that IT should be making decisions on filtering. Yeah, we run the technology, but really, if something's going to be filtered, that needs to be decided based on, you know, curriculum, instruction, and other needs. So, but now we have Untangle, we are able to make those decisions locally, which is great. And let's see. Oh, well, we happened to upgrade our internet from 3 megabit connection to 100 megabit connection just recently here. And when we made that change, our network topology changed. So we needed a firewall, which... that would be the after-school bell. We needed a firewall, and I don't have a firewall laying around. So actually, Untangle will act as a firewall as well. So when I moved Untangle into production, I moved it to a Dell 1850, so it's on server-class hardware. And now it is actually serving as our firewall security appliance for the entire district as well. So that has been pretty good. Let's see. I'll move along to... OpenDNS, I mentioned that earlier. OpenDNS is a it's free service. Again, it doesn't cost. It you point your DNS servers to their service. You sign up. It allows you to filter same kind of categories that you would filter with a web server or a web filter server. But it does it at the DNS level. So if you go to look up a site that's blocked, it's going to return a 404 page or a blocked page. And I don't know about you, but I think having the second layer, I kind of think of it as it's a backup to our Untangle
server. Well, we've had problems once in a while. You know, the Untangle server might go down, and then OpenDNS can fail safe for us. Makes it nice.
Yeah, exactly. And again, it's web-based management. We don't host anything for that. It's just a configuration. Danny or I can go in and make changes on the fly. It's really nice. So that's kind of how we protect our perimeter. Then, let's see. We're doing primarily desktops are for staff use. We do have a couple of labs that are still desktops. But for the rest of the computers on campus, primarily all the student computers, we are running thin client software. And when I first got here, we had a pile of old white box computers that were not being used. And we didn't have computers in the classroom except in a few select computer labs. So I looked at that and I said, well, how can we use these, you know, 60 to 90 machines that are sitting here? And at the time, we were applying for E-Rate, so we applied for terminal servers. So we were able to leverage the E-Rate discount that we received to buy the server hardware. And then we took the old white box computers and using a product based on Linux called 2X, which was free at the time, we were able to transform all those old computers into thin clients, and which was good. I mean, it worked. Unfortunately, 2X is free and not open source, and the free part ended about two versions ago. So we're kind of locked in to this vendor. I'm not going to pay for their services. They're kind of like a poor man's Citrix, and that's really more than what we need, and certainly more than we can afford. So a couple of years ago, we looked at alternatives, and one of the alternatives was to look at the Linux Terminal Server project. And actually, I set up a lab for Danny. It was Danny's classroom lab. It's always good to pick the most technologically savvy person to experiment on.
And the kids love the lab. They went right to it. They actually would come around and say, why aren't there more Linux computers? They didn't know exactly what it called. They just ask, why aren't the other computers like this too?
Which was kind of cool. So I had the LTSP server joined to Active Directory so the students could log in with their regular AD account. We were using OpenOffice instead of Microsoft Office, Firefox instead of IE. And, you know, like Danny said, students really didn't notice the difference. I mean, they knew something was different, and they may even have thought it was better. But, you know, certainly it did not stop them from doing what they needed to do in the classroom. But there were a couple drawbacks. The main one was that LTSP was a kind of a one-to-one mapping, so you needed one server per lab, basically, kind of an architectural issue. Also, we were not able to get Windows Home folders mounted. There were some printer mapping issues, and there really was no redundancy, no load balancing of any kind, which was one of the great features about 2X, being able to load balance six terminal servers without having to worry about how many users would get on one or the other. And so we kind of put that on the back shelf until recently. And Edubuntu now is coming with something called LTSP Cluster. And LTSP Cluster is basically LTSP, but taken to the next level, where we have load balancing capabilities. We have a centralized web-based management. And it will also work. That's what we get for recording in a school. It will also work at as a Windows Terminal Server client, so that I can direct them to through an RDP session if I need to. So we're planning to do a full rollout this summer of LTSP Cluster for all the student computers.
The goal is all non-essential labs will be LTSP, and so the only labs that will not be Ubuntu will be the lab that has to run Photoshop for our yearbook class, basically, and our teachers.
Yeah, and I think that's the plan. I don't know that we've told all the teachers. One of the things about well, one of the things that has enabled us to make this move is that when we decided to go thin client, 6 years ago now, we made a conscious decision to move to web-based applications, because I think we realized, or at least I realized early on, that trying to support like lots of different applications that needed to be installed locally and had permissions and access rights issues was going to be a problem. And we kind of recognized, I made very clear the limitations of terminal services and thin client, and audio multimedia don't work as well as they do on a regular desktop.
Well, the nice thing is with RDP through Microsoft, it's almost next to impossible for audio and visual, especially syncing. But with LTSP, we've noticed that it works pretty well. So that's another reason why we're looking at that.
Yeah, actually, it works really well. So I'm looking forward to that. And then that ties in with our 100 megabit bandwidth and being able to take advantage of that. So that's going to be pretty exciting, I think. And so most of our applications are web-based, which is great. It allows us to concentrate on other things besides having to install and configure and reboot servers all the time. But, desktops and thin clients are fine, but there's this little thing called a netbook that's come out recently. And I think for us, it became very intriguing early on, and we wanted to take a look at it. So this year, we have been running a pilot with one class, and again, we picked Danny's class.
I'm the guinea pig all the time, but that's okay because I get all the cool stuff.
Well, and it works too, because if you have problems with anything, I know you can fix it without having to call me. So, but when I went looking for a solution to run the netbooks, I really did not want to go with Windows, just because I didn't want to have to manage 24 Windows machines that would come and go on the network. I mean, these are machines that we're letting students take home. And I don't remember how. I think I was looking around, and at some point on the internet, I found what Saugus Union High School District was doing.
Jim Klein, he's the man.
Yes, definitely. Jim Klein, JNetman1 on Twitter. But what he's done is he's basically taken the netbook and turned it into a something that's much more like a cell phone, which is, you turn it on, it works. If you have problems, you hold the reset button down, and it goes back to working again. So we have this Linux image from him, which is awesome. It's incredible. He updates it frequently. And it allows us to hand the student a netbook, knowing that no matter what they do to it, in 5 minutes we can reset it back to where it needs to be.
And what's nice is also is we let these things wide open within reason. So if a student wants to change the theme, a student wants to change all the icons to a different style, and they want to make the writing whatever they want, the font whatever they want, they can do all that. And if they screw it up, we can just put it right back to normal. So it makes it nice.
Yeah, so we've been looking at that, because I think moving forward, really, unless there's a specific need, we're much more focused now on a one-to-one environment, and I don't want to buy any more desktops, if we can prevent it. I want to put a computer in the hand of every student rather than have rooms where they have to go to access the internet and, to do all the stuff that we take for granted when we get home every day. So,
well, the other thing is we, to get as many computers on campus lately, we've been using refurbished computers, which, don't get me wrong, they've been wonderful. They've been saving us money, and we've gotten able to have lots of computers on campus. But for the exact same price, we can buy netbooks. And so now they're portable. And so students can take them home, and we can do a lot more with them.
Yeah, and, it's interesting, because I was just at one of our county tech meetings, and we were having a discussion about netbooks. And the common perception... Well, first off, one of my fellow IT directors was talking about a failed implementation with Windows. I think for lots of reasons, not just Windows, but I think it was the complexity of it. And also, I think as adults who are used to using full-size keyboards and notebook computers and the whole deal, we kind of have preconceptions about what's going to work and what's not. You give a student a netbook, and
they're in heaven.
Yeah, I mean, they're happy to have a computer that they can do stuff on.
We've had varied issues with students not taking care of them. More of just because students, it's part of their daily lives. So it's not as this aha thing that we're giving them. It's something that they are used to using. So they treat it a little bit differently than a veteran teacher that might be kind of afraid of the laptop.
Yeah, I mean, to them, it's basically, you know, we haven't moved to digital textbooks yet, but it's kind of like a book. I mean, in fact, we check them out of our system just like a book, and we treat it just like a book. We don't have a separate acceptable use policy. It's kind of covered under instructional materials, which, you know, I think you can find lots of reasons why you shouldn't deploy a one-to-one solution. But I think there are lots of reasons why you should, and I think there's ways to work through it. You know, don't get hung up on it's not going to work because of this.
Don't sweat the small stuff?
Yeah, basically, you know. It's not rocket science, so.
Well, and with Jim Klein's version of UNR, it makes it extremely easy as well.
That's what I like to call stupid simple. So, let's see, what else do we have to talk about? Well, we have our fantastic school website that I won't make fun of it, because really before we had the original website, we didn't have anything. And I know Danny put a lot of effort into designing it, but we have a nice comparison.
I had to learn front page and then from scratch, and so yeah. it was pretty ugly.
Well, front page should say that all. Say it all. But This summer. I guess you played with a couple different solutions,
well,
right?
What's nice is the two of us are the IT department, so Andrew was nice enough to install Elg, and he installed Joomla. We didn't ever put Drupal.
No, we didn't have Drupal.
We also put a WordPress MU server. So we had three different servers running, so I could try to figure out which was the best to run our website off of. And for me, it was hands down WordPress MU.
Yeah, and I mean, it's like night and day looking at the two websites from what we had before to what we have now. And I think what we have now is you've done a lot as far as added that dynamic quality to it, because now we get content happening. I mean, your kids are writing content for our website now.
Well, I went into it with two goals, and that was one was communications, and two was a dynamic website that was very easily dynamic, that I didn't have to do a bunch of work. And with RSS feeds and different things like that, we're able to make that happen. So,
yeah, I mean, when you're doing 18 different things, it's nice to have something simple that you can, that looks like it's takes a lot of time to update and you know, keep current, but really doesn't. So, and that we're running on a virtual machine. It's not taking up hardly any resources. It's running under Ubuntu, and you know, from my perspective, I love it because Danny administers it all. So I just have to make sure the machine stays on.
Well, the nice thing about WordPress MU or any CMS system, content management system, is you have the flexibility of adding users. So I can add my students on with limited rights, and they can get on and add their newsletters and add stories and articles to the website and make small changes. And I can be notified before those things happen, or, you know, I can overlook them and make sure they're correct before they go live for the public.
So you're basically the editor in chief.
Yeah,
and moderator.
If you want to call me that, I guess so. We try to keep it simple as possible, but with the AgCom class, they're writing articles anyhow, so it makes it nice that we can put those up on the front page and not have to worry about the newsletter so much.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great integration. And it's really, I think that and the bulletin have really been a big improvement this year.
Well, moving from a bulletin over the loudspeakers during the morning to a video bulletin every morning, YouTube style, has been nice. And again, it's dynamic. It's fairly simple to do. And then the students have a lot of input on that. So they get to have a little fun with it. And on that same page, we have our RSS feeds from our Twitter accounts for the cafeteria and the school calendar. So Google Calendar to Twitter, and it sends it right up, and I don't have to do a thing. As long as the calendar's up to date, the Twitter feeds keep coming, and the RSS feeds keep, so it makes it nice.
I like that feature. I wish we had it last year, because my students kept asking me, what's for lunch, what's for lunch, what's for lunch? And now, you know, you just say, well, have you checked the calendar, or have you checked the website? Because it's up there. So
yeah, and as long as I have the calendar up to date, and I have the cafeteria menu from the cafeteria manager, no big deal.
Well, I think we're still working on that. And hopefully next year she'll be updating her own Google Calendar, because that takes us to our next item, which is I think we did something that makes a lot of sense for small schools, but I don't know that small schools are actually thinking about this. But we had been on exchange. Actually, when I joined the district, they were on exchange, and I've migrated them now to from 5.5 to 2003 to 2007.
And right after we switched to 2007.
And right after we switched to 2007, I had the brainiac idea of migrating to Google Apps. And part of that is Danny's fault, because 2 years ago?
Almost 3 years now.
3 years ago, Danny created a Google Apps domain for the school and gave every student an email account.
Teachers never used it, though.
I don't think we told them about it.
No.
But every student had a Gmail account.
No training involved. Just opened it up and let them have it. And
And I didn't have to do anything either.
Yeah.
So that was nice. But so I took advantage of that last year when I started teaching. I was teaching business apps classes, and really started leveraging that. And I think we got some more teachers interested in that, just kind of through stealth mode.
Well, I kind of like to call it we started with the students. So Andrew and I, we had our students using it in class, and pretty soon there was more and more students using it, and then other students were asking us about it. And then when the students started asking the teachers, and the teachers came to us saying, hey, what's this Google stuff that the kids keep asking us about? Then that's when we knew. I think that's when we knew it was time.
Yeah. So we kind of had it in stealth mode. And then, you know, I got to the point where I said, well, why aren't we all on the same platform? You know, I mean, we want to be able to do these shared documents and have more collaboration. And, you know, honestly, I'm a one guy IT shop here, and I have a lot of other things to do, too. So I'm not a big fan of managing the Exchange server. You know, I do believe that you build it the right way the first time and you shouldn't have any problems, which we haven't. But I didn't want it to have to take care of it anymore, really. I didn't want it to have to worry about backups or have to worry about when the power crashed, it was going to come back up. So Google Apps, I think, made a very compelling argument. Our students had been using it for a couple years, and I had been using it in the classroom and really liked it. And I had been using it personally for several years and really liked it. So we made the decision to jump in a little earlier than I thought we were going to. We kind of did it mid-year, which is...
Don't do that.
No.
Word advice. Wait till summer.
Yeah, that actually goes against one of my fundamental tenets of school IT, which is don't do big projects in the middle of the year. But we did for a funny reason, actually. I think it all goes back to Acer. I will blame Acer, because Acer did something really smart in education. They sent us two free netbooks to evaluate.
Seed the school program.
Yes, their school seed program. And I shouldn't really say free, because we had to buy them at half price. But basically, they sent them with no PO required. They showed up on our doorstep. We started playing with them big time and really realized the potential. And so from that kind of stemmed our pilot program. But the other funny thing that happened was that one day, Danny and I were sitting in the gym for a parent night, both on our netbooks. And
yeah, it was actually this year, just a few months ago.
And I think some of the teachers, kind of tug in cheek, were talking about, hey, where are they getting their, when are they getting their netbooks? But, yeah. You know, I basically said, well, you know.
Well, they were our personal netbooks, because we were paying for them afterwards. You know, we got them for half price through the Seed the Schools program, but we purchased them. So he said, you know, they're real cheap. They're down at Costco. You can buy them real cheap. And somebody mentioned we have something called Mom Money, which is we get for helping our students with the health agency, and somebody mentioned that, and Andrew and I looked at each other and we said, that's it, we have to do it.
Yeah, so basically I told the teachers, I say, you know, well, if you want them, why don't you ask for them? Kind of not expecting them to, but they did. And so we ended up not only deploying netbooks for our teachers, but in the process, because I really wanted them to be on the same platform that the students were on, we actually we gave them Linux netbooks and we gave them training. We did 3 days of training with them. And at the same time, we trained them on Google Apps, and I moved them over to Gmail.
So in a matter of 3 months, we did netbooks, Google training, netbook training, and teacher 2.0 training, and we got them in and out, and now every staff member has a netbook and is on Google Apps. And
More Exchange server, no more Outlook clients to worry about.
And we're still training, because some things aren't there yet, quite there yet for everybody, but they're learning, and it works well, and we're using them every day. Every time we have a collaboration day, we're on the netbooks and in Google Apps sharing stuff.
So I think it's interesting, because we've kind of done two things. We've introduced teachers to Ubuntu Linux, which I think is awesome, because our students will be on it next year. And we have also set the tone for collaboration and using netbooks in a collaborative environment, which I think is where we're trying to go with some of our classes next year, if we expand out our pilot.
Yeah, we're trying something new with our freshmen, but another story. But hopefully it'll work down from the teachers, and the teachers see the benefit and the power of these collaborative tools on Google, and we can leverage that with our classrooms as well.
Yeah, so and getting back to the migration, really the biggest thing for me was that when we did trainings, I was surprised at how little of the Outlook features, the advanced Outlook features, our users actually used. And so giving them the web interface, which I think, you know, a lot of them had been using Outlook Web Access for home access anyway, and a lot of them had Yahoo Webmail and maybe even some Gmail anyway, so they were kind of used to this idea.
What's nice is when we went into the training, and the first question we'd ask is about the advanced Outlook features, and nobody even knew what they were. It was very easy to show them the cool, simple advanced features with Google and Gmail, and they would be amazed at what they could do with their email accounts that they were never doing with Outlook. So it made it kind of a fun sell for our staff.
Yeah, and I think that was a huge thing. I mean, the most complicated thing about it was explaining the difference between a label and a folder, and trying to make that distinction.
I don't think they get it yet.
No, I would agree. Now I think our biggest challenge is getting people to click yes or no when we send them a calendar invite.
And with nested labels, now it's going to be even worse. But yeah, the calendar is probably the biggest thing now, is we're trying to make sure people use the free busy feature and everything. It makes the collaboration process a lot simpler.
Yeah. So, but I think overall it's been a very positive experience, and we're just starting to really look at leveraging all those tools. I have been using Google Forms in my class like crazy to basically build worksheets and surveys and to be able to interact with my students. So I've found it, you know, even from last year, I'm really starting to use it more in my class.
I'm using Forms as a timesheet for my students, so for my AgCom class, because it's a production-based class, basically. So they have to fill out a form every day telling me what they worked on and what they accomplished for the day, and so it makes it nice because I'm collecting data from the students every day. And then we use Google Apps, the Google Docs, and sharing Google Docs with one another for articles consistently, so it makes it simple to share. I can look at it, make edits, another student can make edits, have another student that translates for us, and so it makes it real nice.
Yeah, I mean, just the collaboration aspects alone are phenomenal, and we're not even tapping into a tenth of it, I think, so I'm really looking forward to seeing that develop over time. The other thing I like, just to wrap up the Google Apps stuff, is that it's a web-based administration. Both Danny and I can manage it really easily. I think on Exchange, Danny, I was pretty much, because it was more complicated. So like even adding new users and stuff, that was pretty much me.
Yeah, I could fumble my way through, but I probably end up screwing something up.
Yeah, so the web interface on Google Management Console, I mean, it's awesome. For especially somebody who doesn't want to dive into the details of activating and setting up email accounts and all that stuff. But anyway.
One thing we wish they would fix is Google is the best search engine out there, of course, and the worst thing on their management console is searching for users.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's one thing. There's lots of others. But that one thing is funny to me because they are a search company. And to have to know the first, to have to match the first part of the user's name is incredibly ridiculous to me. I should be able to search on any part of that account name.
The bad part is you can't search for a user by their first and last name. You have to search by their username.
And you have to get the first characters right.
And so it makes it
it's like they're matching their search string on that field is a little bit messed up. So anyway, but and actually maybe we should do a show on what they need to fix, because I have a few more than that, but we can cover that some other time. So small school big tech, it's kind of a philosophy and a series of trials and errors that we've kind of been doing for the last 6 years. But basically, you know, we try to make do with what we have and do as much as we can with what we have. We're always looking, at least, you know, both of us, we're always looking for free and open source, because we just don't have the funds to go out and pay for all the fancy stuff.
Well, and the best place for that we found is Twitter. We find so much information on Twitter, and we're always sending each other messages because, hey, did you see that link on Twitter? Did you check that out? So that's if you're not on Twitter and you're in the IT field, you definitely need to be there.
Well, and yeah, if you are, find me, send me a message or something, because I don't find a lot of IT people out there. And I'd really like to see more like sysadmin, network admin types out there, sharing resources and sharing information.
And not only that, if you're a teacher, you should be on Twitter. Just look for, do a search for educators or teachers. You're going to find quite a few people in there, and there is a ton of great resources that you can find on Twitter, things to use in your classroom all the time. So, make sure you check it out.
Yeah, definitely. So, then there's the idea that you really need to focus on what you do best and think about outsourcing the rest. I mean, we are in the age of Google. The cloud is here. You know, yeah, sure, I can run an Exchange server. Am I an Exchange Uber expert admin? No. You know, do I know the ins and outs of all the Exchange security issues and all that stuff? No. You know, does Google understand security and know how to manage servers? Yes. So why not host it with them? Why not have our email services run by them? Now, if we have an outage, something goes wrong. It was like a delayed access problem. As soon as I noticed it and pointed it out to somebody, by the time I went back to look at it, it was fixed.
Well,
so
we didn't have to fix it.
Exactly. Yeah. It's not my problem anymore, other than, you know, I can open a support ticket, but, really, it's nice to know that there are experts out there working on it. And if something is not working, you know, I don't have to spend all my time trying to figure out what's going on.
Well, and according to the last Twig podcast, which if you listen to This Week in Tech or This Week in Google, Leo Laporte and Jeff Jarvis, and there is a rumor that Google has well over 1 million servers. And the next closest was Intel with about a couple hundred thousand. So just right, that alone tells you how well your data is going to be backed up, how easy it is to be redundant in that that manner.
Yeah, I mean, it's all distributed out in the cloud. I think we have, what, 20 servers right now, something like that.
And that's pretty good, because we started, when you got here, we had two.
Yeah. Actually, half of them are off right now, but that's another story too. And then, something interesting, we both had a tour of Google a couple months ago, and something somebody said there was pretty incredible to me, which was that the IT department's job at Google is to remove impediment to
innovation.
Innovation. Thank you. And, you know, you could rephrase that really easy for education. You could say remove impediment to learning. You know, so I try to focus on that now and really.
And I don't know about you, but most IT departments we come across for education are the biggest impediments to learning on campus.
I would tend to agree. I think definitely progressive element there, but I think on the whole, there definitely is a, there is this perception that, you know, IT has the no, we can't do that philosophy. I think part of it too is having just started teaching last year, that experience has kind of transformed my perception of, IT's roles and responsibilities and, the direction that I should be taking as an IT person, in a school district.
That reminds me of, attending last SETPA conference. I went to a great presentation. I forgot the gentleman's name off the top of my head right now. But he was an IT gentleman, and his presentation was basically on why every IT person should teach at least one class, or maybe not a class, but at least teach. And so they can see the process and understand what's going on and get the feel and not just be back behind the scenes.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, I tell people that I'm teaching now, and they look at me like I'm crazy. And I tell them, it is actually the hardest job I've ever had. And I think a lot of that has to do with, there are so many elements in the room that you have to track, and really, if something's not working technology wise, you know, that can become a huge distraction. And that becomes something that's very hard to deal with, especially for teachers who aren't tech savvy. You know, like if I have a technical problem in the classroom, I can fix it pretty quick. And it doesn't really distract me from my class and what I need to do with my students. But for a teacher who really doesn't feel comfortable with technology in the first place, to have something not work in the middle of a lesson is really going to throw them off.
Well, and it's scary, and they're so caught up in needing to use that one device that they basically are done. They can't finish the lesson.
Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking of my projector right now, which has a tendency to shut off after every 5 minutes. You know, something like that, if that's happening in a teacher's classroom and they have built their entire lesson around using that projector for that day, that's a huge impact on them. So anyway, it's really changed my perspective. I mean, I started IT on the customer service side, so I kind of come from a customer service background anyway, rather than like a traditional IT, we must control and lock down everything perspective. But it has been really beneficial to me, I think, to be in the classroom teaching. So, and then my favorite is you can never have enough bandwidth. We just went from 3 megabit to 100 megabit, and I think it has made an incredible difference, especially since we've been using Web 2.0 tools for the last 2 years, but we've really been having a problem with bandwidth when everybody starts using them at the same time.
Well, the biggest thing was we never knew if it was our bandwidth or if we just had a flaky Web 2.0 tool, which sometimes you do find, and we've come to find that most of the tools we were having problems with, it was because of our bandwidth and not because the website was flaky.
Yeah. So I'm really looking forward to being able to use those tools a lot more now that we've got our bandwidth upgrade. And also it's going to open up a whole bunch of other possibilities. I never would have thought about moving staff to Google Apps had we not been upgrading our bandwidth.
Well, just the being able to do Skype alone is just a huge added feature for us.
Yeah, I can't wait to see when you start bringing in people from outside. That'll be real cool to have Skype going. So bandwidth, it's going to be an issue. If it's not an issue already, you should make it one of your top priorities, I would think.
Well, in the newest version of EdTech, I don't know if anybody gets that. It's a magazine for technology insights for leaders in tech in education. And there's a huge article about schools going 10 gigabit.
10 gigabit. That would be nice.
Internal.
Yeah, that would still be nice. Maybe in our next E-rate network upgrade, we'll go 10 gigabit. But I just think, you know, I know a lot of schools that are struggling with internet bandwidth. I think maybe a lot of the filtering that takes place is a direct result of not having enough bandwidth and not being able to open things up like YouTube to teachers. And I think that's unfortunate. The amount of resources out there is just incredible. And that's one of those that, you know, as a small school, we don't have a lot of resources. We don't have a lot of money to spend on software, educational applications, these kind of things that you might see at larger districts. And there are tons free of free tools. Yeah, free is good. There are amazing number of free tools out there if you can get to them, you know, and if you're struggling with not enough bandwidth, it makes it really hard to do that. So anyway, a good example of that is like Aviary, which is now enabled in our Google Apps account for students. If you can't afford Photoshop, if you don't have Photoshop, but you've got bandwidth, you know, Aviary is free and you can do a lot of the stuff in Aviary that you can do in Photoshop.
And in my opinion, unless you have a class centered around learning the ideas of Photoshop, Aviary is the only way to go because it's free. It's with Google Apps. They save it right there in the cloud and the tools on there is amazing. So,
yeah. I mean, don't get us started into how we came about having Photoshop on campus, but that's a whole nother story. So bandwidth, that's one of the things that I think is enabling us going forward. And then, you know, just some buzzwords, standardize, centralize, and manage. And when I got here, initially I was working for, they had me split between two districts, so I was doing part-time duty at both. And I looked at things and said, well, how am I going to manage these two environments and grow? Because at the time, the big push was for more computers. You know, we want computers in every classroom. We want students on computers. And so I really looked at it and I broke it down and I said, the only way to do that is, you know, we got to have standardization so that it's easy to manage. We got to centralize management so that I'm not having to run all over the place. And that's how we got the thin client. It's kind of what took us to netbooks and this whole idea of web apps and all of that kind of stemmed from this. The question was, you know, how do you grow technology at a site when you don't have the resources or the manpower really that you need to make that happen? So, and kind of what I mean by manage, I'm going to tempt fate here and say since I have been here, we have not had a major unplanned outage in the last 6 years. So I'm now going to knock on some wood because we've been really lucky, I think. But a lot of that has to do with kind of this philosophy that I'm going to talk about here in a second. And, you know, we have stuff. Power outage happens. We actually happens more than I would like to see, but we are out in a rural area, so power tends to go out.
And when we lose power, it's not just 30 seconds. It's a couple hours usually.
Yeah, or sometimes like half a day, which happened, a couple weeks ago?
Over break, yeah.
Yeah, that was fun. When I say, you know, I say part luck, of course, but also there's a philosophy, and it comes from this Gartner study that I found, which is 80%, it says 80% of unplanned downtime is caused by people or process, which basically says to me that, and that came from a CNET article, that was Donna Scott from Gartner saying that. And basically what that tells me is that 80% of system outages are self-inflicted. So you make a change, it crashes the system, or you apply an update and it crashes your system, or you upgrade some hardware and it crashes the system. So something you do, or maybe you have a process in place that, you know, doesn't take into account good backup procedures, for example. Let's say you do an Aries update and you corrupt your database and you don't have a backup in place because you don't have a good process for that.
And for those of you not in California, an Aries update would be your SIS.
Yeah, sorry. And for those of you who have no idea what a SIS is, that would be your student information system, kind of where you store all your student records.
So that would be a bad deal if we lost all that information.
Yes, and I've seen that happen at a few districts. But if you were a big organization, you would look at something like ITIL, which is Information Technology Infrastructure Library. It's a series of like this huge volume of books that has a whole bunch of processes and procedures. And it defines roles and responsibilities. And I think if we were going to implement that here, Danny and I would end up with another 15 titles each, just so we could all fill those roles. And really, you know, for a small organization, it's kind of an impossible task to look at that. But probably one of the best books I have ever had recommended to me that kind of focuses the most important aspects of ITIL for a small organization is called The Visual Ops Handbook, Starting ITIL in Four Critical Steps. It is probably one of the smallest IT books I've ever read. It's only 96 pages. And it really looks at how do you control people and process so that you limit that 80% of outages. And it really allows you to focus on being proactive and meeting the needs of the organization rather than running around in what I like to call firefighter mode, putting out fires because, you know, your Exchange server is crashing, it's running out of space. You know, your internet's going up and down because you haven't upgraded your router or, you know, things like that happen and usually tend to happen in places where you don't have time to do things that you really need to be doing. And so I think this book really helped me kind of, it kind of put into words some of the things that I'd been doing for quite a long time and didn't really realize it. So I would say that's a very good read if you're interested in trying to get yourself out of this constant firefighter mode and you want to be more proactive and get a handle on things, that book, The Visual Ops Handbook, is definitely a good place to start. So, wow, that's kind of small school big tech. I don't know. That went pretty good.
We're presenting on at CVQ in Fresno on Saturday the 24th.
Yes.
And so if you happen to make it, great. If not, you can go to our website, smallschoolbigtech.com, and follow along with this podcast and look at the PowerPoint slides. And basically that's what we just went over, is the PowerPoint of the presentation that we're going to be doing this Saturday.
And our contact information's up there. I am on the SETPA listserv. I'm on Twitter at Another Schwab. My blog post is up there. My email's up there. I'm happy to take comments or suggestions or get in contact with me, you have any questions. Danny is being optimistic and assuming that we get this posted before Saturday, but
I think we will. We'll be on there by right before.
we'll probably be posting from our iPhone on the drive down.
There you go.
Anyway, this has been fun, exciting. It's our first podcast.
Ready to go.
We need some kind of closer.
Dun dun dun.
Okay, well, this is Small School Big Tech. Andrew and Danny signing off.
Music by Kevin MacLeod.
Who's doing the intro? I'm gonna sit back like this and talk like a rock star. No. Yeah, I don't think I'm going to be typing. That's just chat. The Danny Silva chat show.
Well, you do an intro, so we can always cut over time.
I hope you're a good audio engineer, because I don't know how to use any of this stuff. Okay. Welcome to Small School Big Tech, Episode 1.